Hi everybody, it's James from the future here. Today's episode is a little bit of an experiment. It's part of the My Favorite Monster series, which is a series that I really love doing, but I don't do as often as I might because there are some technical challenges involved in making it. The thing about My Favorite Monster is that the audio is often pretty challenging to mix because it comes from multiple different sources, and not to get too much into it, but it's a pain. You know, it's not that it's actually super difficult, but it's much more time consuming. And as a result, I don't do as many of those episodes. Now, this episode, what I have done is just used audio that comes directly from the recording of the Zoom call that was part of the interview. And you'll definitely be able to hear that the quality of this audio is not as good as the normal audio quality of Monster Man. The question is it good enough? Because it definitely makes it a lot easier for me to make the episode. So would you prefer to hear the interviews in higher audio quality, but accepting that they might be farther apart or there might be fewer of them as a result? Or are you okay with this level of audio quality and you'd like to hear future My Favorite Monster episodes be in this format? Let me know. If you're a Patreon subscriber, let me know in the Patreon comments. If you're not, catch me on social media. You can hear where I can be found at the end of this episode. Thanks for your time. I now return you to your regularly scheduled episode. Monster Man, special episode, My Favorite Monster, with Joe Lewis. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a My Favorite Monster special, one of that irregular series of episodes where I talk with game creators about, well, I mean, their favorite monsters, like it says in the title. My guest today is Joe Lewis. Joe is a fantasy writer, game designer, and wannabe illustrator. He's probably best known for writing the Dungeon Age adventures on DriveThruRPG, as well as the Elf Saga, Ethereum, and Angels and Djinn book series. His adventure, Nightmare Over Ragged Hollow, is currently on Kickstarter from the Merry Mushmen. Joe, welcome to the show.
Hi, James. It's so nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on. So normally what we do on these My Favorite Monster episodes is we start with a little bit of background about you. So why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got into gaming and how you went from there to writing games? Now, I notice you also write fiction. Is that, did one proceed from the other? Like, did you start with fiction and move into gaming, or was it a simultaneous thing?
In terms of writing and actual publishing, it was from fiction to gaming. But all of that fantasy stuff has been a huge blur across my life, starting from a very young age. I spent my very young years hanging out at the local library, and I would just sit in the aisles and read, mostly in the fantasy sort of aisles, which included a copy of, I think it was second edition, Player's book, which I found, and I didn't know what it was. I was a young child of the 80s, but I found it fascinating. It was full of fantasy stuff, and I just sat on the floor of the aisle, and I would pull it out week after week and read it. And it wasn't until many years later that I actually started finding other gamers and learning how to play these as actual games, but it was all just reference material. I grew up reading tons of mythology and Tolkien and any kind of fantasy you could get your hands on from like the 70s and 80s mostly. And it wasn't until I think college really that I started meeting people who introduced me to actual games, playing D&D and Rifts and things that came out of the 90s. But then we fast forward even more years and until my 30s, and then I finally found an actual group of gamers and we started playing D&D regularly. And I started, of course, as a player, and then I graduated to DM. And somewhere in there, I was also writing all these novels. I think I wrote 27 fantasy novels of various sorts over like the last 10 years. And that evolved into writing gaming materials.
We've had other guests who are active in sort of more than one media. Levi Nunez, for instance, who's a game designer and a musician. But I'm always curious about how the experience is comparable across the two things. Like, what do you find about writing game stuff that's different from writing fiction?
Writing fiction, you pull a big pile of creativity out of you, and then you spend months trying to mush it out into character arcs and plot arcs that make sense in this one, you know, long, complete, I don't want to say product, but piece of art, whatever it is, this book thing. It's kind of esoteric. It's hard to get people to interact with it. So you don't get a lot of feedback. You don't know if you did a good job. And you're pouring all this very specific personal stuff, you know, their relationships with people and that you pull out of your own life. So it's very unique. And you're doing it entirely alone. You sit by yourself. You're the tortured artist and you turn out your book. And the gaming stuff, you still pull all this big wad of creativity out of you, but then you just organize all your ideas and it becomes a technical writing exercise, which is great for me because that's my actual career, as I've spent the last 20 years as a technical writer, working with engineers and software developers and doctors and stuff. So organizing content is what I do. So I just realized I can just organize all my creativity and it becomes a game product. And then you actually get to play test it with people. And then the moment you publish it, people start playing it and they give you feedback. And there's a lot more interaction with people because it happens much faster. I can write an adventure in, you know, a matter of days and weeks versus writing a book, which takes, you know, months to even years. So there's a faster turnaround cycle, and there's more feedback, and there's more of a social aspect to it. You know, you get to talk to people and see them play it and tell you what their experience was. So that was a great evolution for me to get to do that.
That's interesting that you said, you know, that as you say, it's you take these things and then you organize them. One of the things that I noted when I was reading Nightmare Over Ragged Hollow, which the Mary Mushman were kind enough to send over an advanced copy.
Oh, it's fantastic.
It's a beautiful, beautiful book. But was the sort of insistence that this is not, you know, that this is a situation, not a narrative, right?
Sure.
Which is something that I think is in line with kind of, I mean, I don't want to talk about the OSR. That's a contentious term, you know, and I don't know that these labels are helpful necessarily. But
it is tricky.
With that style of gaming that we would expect, like if you had read previous Mary Mushman things, right, that would be the kind of style that they would advocate. But that's not actually your background in terms of game publishing, right?
That's true. So in my 30s, when I got back into gaming very seriously, I was introduced to it in D&D 5e. Mm-hmm. Played that for years, and I started DMing that originally. And there's obviously more of a focus on, there's an assumption that the characters are going to survive and they're going to be heroic, and you're not necessarily playing for gold, you're playing for the story almost, which is great. It's its own style of play. Then you get introduced to, you know, when I went online and I discovered there's this whole vibrant community of developers who are focused on older styles of play or inventing entirely new styles of play, which is also fantastic. Completely different games, completely different mechanics, completely different goals, and the reasons that the people want to get together, either sliding all the way towards the story end and the mechanics almost don't matter, towards the crunchier end where it's much more towards board gaming. And there's this fantastic spectrum of types of games and types of gamers. So I've been learning more about that and evolving through that too.
So, and we'll return to some of this when we talk at the end of this episode, a little bit about Nightmare Over Ragged Hollow. But let's get to the center of today's episode, which is I was delighted when I asked you to choose a monster for this episode and you said you wanted to talk about mummies.
Because mummies, absolutely.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, now partly this is because my background is as an archaeologist and archaeological horror stories fascinate me. I also think, you know, mummies are very interesting because they are one of that group of monsters that, you know, appears in AD&D, you know, and D&D right from the jump, but which is not a fantasy monster particularly, right? Like they're a horror.
It's a real thing. It's a real
aspect of our
real world that we've then brought into the fantasy world.
Yeah, and I think that connection, even though it's a connection that exists, well, because it's a connection that exists only in the mind of the players rather than of the characters, actually makes them very effective. But so tell me a little bit about why you chose this monster to be the subject for your episode.
Sure. I, as a game developer and a game runner and player, I really like when the monster is tied into the story and the setting and it has a purpose versus, you know, you go into a random room and there's a random wolf and you kill it and you randomly get a pile of gold coins. You're like, why was a wolf in a room and why did it have gold coins? And that's less satisfying to me both as a creator and as a player than when it's all tied together. I think the mummy is a fantastic exemplar of a creature that brings all of the elements for a great game. Just when you say the word mummy, instantly in our Western minds from our culture, we associate it with so many things that are both real and supernatural or fantastic that lead to great gameplay and storytelling. The natural aspects from the real world that we get, as soon as you say mummy, you know that there's some kind of culture, there's a group of people who have this complex relationship with death. They're doing a very complex ritual of embalming and preserving a body. So they have some kind of religious or other cultural relationship with death that's very unique and special. And then the next thing you think of when the mummy itself is an individual who was mummified because they were important or special to these people. So, you know, they were a religious leader or a royalty or what have you, a very just wealthy person. So now you know that this is an important person within the context of the culture. And then you have the tomb. The tomb is not just a random crypt. It's something very special that was built to house this person, you know, in the afterlife or in the next life or whatever it may be for the culture, which could be as grandiose as building a literal mountain with the pyramid or something else. Of course, we have other real mummies in the world with the Aztecs and the Incas and the Australians and people of Oceania. But mostly in our Western mind, I think we tend to think of Egyptian mummies. And then the fourth important natural thing is when you go into the tomb, it's full of treasure. And that treasure isn't random. It's something that you're giving to the mummified individual to enjoy or benefit from or use in the afterlife. So there's this great coherent narrative with all of those elements that ties together, which are all the elements that we use in a dungeon delve in a fantasy adventure, except this time you don't have to invent it or make up an excuse for it. It all comes together perfectly. Just when you say the word mummy, you get all that information. And that's a great start for any developer or designer or as a GM running the game.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think you're exactly right in terms of what it immediately conveys to players, you know, and some of that, as you say, comes from, you know, what those things are like in the real world. And then some comes from kind of the tradition of mummies in media. But then even that kind of that itself comes from, well, I was going to say from real world events, from highly fictionalized reporting about real world events. But like, if you look at mummy stories from sort of the 19th century, you know, which is kind of like the beginning of the 19th century is really the beginning of Western literary fascination with mummy stories in the 19th century are not avenging, lumbering, whatever. Like, that's not part of it. They're stories about communicating with people like over distances of time, or they're kind of more conventional ghost stories.
Absolutely. Yep.
It's really post Tutankhamun where, you know, there's this sort of media thing about the curse or whatever.
Sure.
That you start to get the idea of the vengeful mummy, and then becomes the film franchise, and then it just, you know, goes from there. One thing that I think is really interesting, you talked about the idea that this is a monster that kind of brings with it all these questions that you have to answer, right? Oh, I want a mummy in this dungeon. Well, who was it? Who mummified them? Who, you know, you can't have it without answering some questions about its context. And one of the things I think is really interesting about that context is that there's an element of guilt to it, because when you start to think about that context, you start to think about the question like, oh, are we really supposed to be here? Are we?
No, it absolutely feels much more like we are literally robbing a grave.
Yeah.
And we see that in the real world. Like, the British Museum is currently relabeling mummies as mummified remains, and they're trying to change the language and be a little more respectful of the fact that they are just human bodies.
Yeah.
And it's one thing to study these things and respect them, but it's something else to just, you know, profit from
it. Yeah, and it is interesting. You can see there's a big debate about, there has been historically a big debate about this kind of like putting human remains on museum display. And of course, it's, shall we say, human remains from certain cultures and from certain parts of the world are much more frequently put on display. Yes. Than human remains from other cultures and other parts of the world, which is to say that like some people are thought of as other people and some people are thought of as other objects, which...
Right. We don't tend to display our own dead in our culture, but we are willing to do so to other people's, which is,
yeah, absolutely.
Problematic, to say the least.
And the mummy as a kind of classic movie monster or whatever is, you know, is sympathetic in that respect. Like, in particular, the later versions of it, right? If you know, the Hammer mummy is punishing colonialist hubris, right? Like, he kind of has
it,
a point.
It can be used. Absolutely. Then those are the best villains, the ones that are right. So it's not just a monster that comes out and harms people at random, but it could be defending, you know, it's either its tomb space or the culture around it, the people who are still very much alive, even if the mummy represents, you know, a dynasty from thousands of years ago. The people, the rest of the nation is still very much there. And mm-hmm. the mummy can therefore be some kind of powerful individual who is defending the rest of the culture that's still alive.
You know, having said that, I think, you know, another thing that you pointed out was mummy is a backstory. It's a premise for a monster. It's not a description of the
sure.
monster. But if you look at like a D&D mummy, they're kind of not that exciting, like especially early versions. They do get elaborated as the game develops. But early mummy is just kind of like punch you.
It's right. It's essentially a ghoul or a zombie or
yeah, just a very powerful one, yeah,
with a twist on it, which is disappointing, because especially if you've seen more of the modern mummy type films or just any kind of films, there are so many possibilities for adding fantastical elements to something that the idea that it just shuffles out and punches you and breathes disease on you is underwhelming.
Certainly when AD&D second edition came out, they had added another tier of mummy to try and give you your more sort of super villain.
Sure.
You know,
there's two tiers in 5e too. There's a mummy and a mummy lord.
Yeah. Those are the guys. Again, this is something that comes up in a lot of horror monsters, because the thing that's scary about the mummy in a horror context is like the emotional and intellectual weight that it carries, more so than like it's a physical challenge, because who it's beating up is just like archaeologists. You know what I mean? Like, they're not down there with
swords. Sure, on film, whatnot. Absolutely.
Yeah, like, and there's just a difference between, you know, fighting a paladin and fighting an Egyptologist. But if you look at, you know, insofar as there are ancient Egyptian, like, tomb curse texts, which do exist, they're much more, they're not saying, like, I will come back in physical form and strangle you, except for one. There is one, actually. Which
is there?
Yeah, it says that if someone violates this tomb, I forget the exact wording, but the threat is, I will seize him by the neck like a bird, which I just like, I imagine that it's referring to like wringing a bird's neck.
Right.
You know, like, no, when you're going
to even that's more evocative than just it punches you. What if it very specifically wants to strangle you because it has this very specific fascination with necks? I mean, that's better.
And it has the kind of like, oh, you're like an animal to me, right?
Right.
Like,
I'm above you and you're beneath me. I'm not the monster. You are.
Yeah. And it doesn't say I'm going to murder you. It says I'm going to slaughter you, which is, you know, for you is the same.
Right. The context is different.
Yeah, exactly. But so I like that idea about a mummy as something that brings context and, again, another loaded term, but it brings story.
It's more thoughtful. It's more interesting, I think, for both the player and the person running the story.
Right. It raises questions. There's a lot of familiarity with the mummy. And I think that can be both a strength and a weakness. So people, you know, oh, we're going to an ancient tomb. It's full of grave goods. And we're starting to think to ourselves, all right, we're going to get the Pharaoh's curse. Everybody knows how this works. And sometimes that's good because people like that stuff. People like familiar monster context to a certain extent, right? Everybody likes to do the Pharaoh's curse once.
Hopefully.
But given the range of different opportunities, you know, what do you do to avoid that sense of familiarity? A listener and friend of the show, Steve Dempsey, once said to me, and I think about it all the time, Cthulhu is scary like Dracula is scary, which is to say, he isn't.
No, that's right, absolutely
how do you,
a problem.
How do you combat that familiarity? What are some of the elements that you might introduce?
Well, my personal approach to dealing with all monster design over, I've been doing this for like, I guess, 5 years now. I have never used a by the book monster in anything I've ever written. I've completed original whole cloth monsters, even if it's just a new version of a skeleton. I want it to be different, both for, you know, the fun factor and the originality of it for the people at the table, but also so when the player is told, you know, there's a figure shambling towards you, they don't know exactly what it is or what it can do or how to interact with it, and they get to learn, experience, and discover that, which is part of the fun. If you already have memorized the monster manual, then you're just playing, you know, chess, which I think is less exciting than what we think of when we think of a board game or a role-playing game. Sorry. So when I want to design a new mummy, if I was going to do this as a new adventure, which I actually am in the very near future, I have a mummy-based adventure coming out. What I would want to do first is I like the Matt Colville approach, which you think about what is the fantasy that you're trying to evoke in your game. So for me, the fantasy of the mummy comes from the 1999 The Mummy film with Brendan Fraser, because I loved that movie when it came out, and it was evocative of things like Indiana Jones, and it was just thematic and grabbed onto me. But also it had great visuals and a lot of powers for the monster, and you keep discovering them as the movie goes along. So there are environmental effects, like controls sandstorms, things like that, and just sand in general. It has creature effects. There are swarms of scarabs that's, you know, come out of the walls and attack people and eat your flesh, and they're horrific. I think it summons jackals up out of the ground at some point, and it has warrior minions, which are like lesser versions of or skeletal warriors or mummy warriors. Minions are fantastic because you can feel heroic killing a whole bunch of them, and you can also feel threatened because there are a whole bunch of them and you don't know when they're going to come from. And also in the mummy movies, the mummy has a consort. He's in love with this Egyptian princess, so you can bring in other characters who are intelligent that you can interact with, who have desires and, you know, fears and goals, so they can help evolve your story, make it more complex and interesting.
To the consort point, if you've never seen the Russell Mulcahy film, I think it's called Talos the Mummy, but it's often just called The Mummy or like Tale of the Mummy. It's not good or anything, but it does have an actually very good twist on the reincarnated Egyptian princess bit, which is maybe the only thing worth kind of writing home about it, unfortunately. But as you say, right, because the thing is originally a person, right, it has objectives, sure. It has an agenda, and you can give it a personal, the reincarnated Egyptian princess, like, on the one hand is a well-worn bit, but on the other hand, it does something that is quite rare, which is it gives a creature a personal relationship with a character without the character having a reciprocal relationship,
absolutely.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, no. Yeah. They had a contentious relationship. She, you know, do they want to be resurrected? Do they want to be together? You know, do they care about each other at all? Those are the kinds of things you can introduce into any dynamic. And of course, all those things I've been talking about here are I've placed in sort of Egyptian desert kind of context. But when we bring a mummy into a fantasy context, it could be in any environment. This could be in a swamp. This could be in the highlands or the mountains. And all of those creature effects or environmental effects can be appropriate to whatever that environment is.
If you like high altitude arid environments are often very good for just producing mummified bodies kind of by themselves.
Absolutely.
And if you, for non-squeamish listeners, go do like an image search for the Chachapoya mummies, they are simultaneously fascinating and horrifying. Just because it turns out that when your flesh becomes dried out and desiccated, sometimes what that means is that your face forms into an eternal horrific shriek.
For listeners who are less squeamish, I can assure you that if you look up mummies of all sorts, both natural and human-made, there are many with almost intact faces who are, they look at complete rest and repose. They often would die of natural causes, especially in South America, high in the Andes and those kinds of environments, Peru. People would pass away. They would be, you know, laid to rest, perhaps in a high altitude cave, and the body would just be very well preserved because of the temperature and the low oxygen levels. And today, well, not today, because we've lost so many of them over the last couple of centuries, but when they were originally seen, and the ones that we do still have today, they still have many of their features. They almost look like just people who are asleep, which is an amazing ability to be able to look at someone who lived, you know, 500, 1,000 years ago. And especially in those South American cultures, those mummies were a part of daily life. Incan cultures, they would mummify, you know, royalty and leaders and stuff like that. And those individuals would then remain in a palace with human servants who would bring them food, and they would continue to exist in luxury. And the people of that community would know that those leaders, even though they're dead, are still physically there. You can go look at them. When those cultures went to war with each other, this is fascinating, they would deliberately try to capture the mummies of the other nations and take them back and say, we now have your connection to the afterlife. We have your spiritual connection to your ancestors, and maintain that. That was a part of daily life. You could see them and interact with them if you wanted to. And that's fascinating. I can't imagine what our culture would be like if we could do that.
That I think is very relevant to this monster is this idea of the dead continuing to have an active presence in society, continue to be present in the landscape. That's something that exists in many cultures. You get it, for instance, in the way that like saints' bodies are viewed in medieval Europe, for instance. But yeah, it's true in a lot of places. Well, it's in a number of cultures in the Neolithic Near East, but I think there's examples from Çatalhöyük where there are we interpret them as ancestors, some kind of people, buried underneath sleeping platforms. So people would actually be sleeping on top of a grave, or at Jericho, for instance, there are human skulls that are kind of decorated and were kept in, you know, what may have been residences. So these kinds of ongoing connections, I think, something that like a lot of fantasy cultures don't have, because fantasy cultures tend to be more modern than their creators would like to think they are.
That's very true. That's a good insight.
Now, we are running low on time, so I do want to move on to ask you some quick questions about Nightmare Over Ragged Hollow, because this
Absolutely.
Is something this is a reworking of a scenario that you published some time ago.
Yes, several years ago, I published an adventure called Ragged Hollow Nightmare, which I invented because I had a bunch of new players, and I wanted to give them the full new player experience with a starting village that had all the classics and tropes, but I wanted it to all be well organized, so I clumped it all together and had that adventure. And then last year, I was approached by the Merry Mushmen, a fantastic development team, publisher team over in Europe. They've pulled together all these great designers and artists, and we have this new edition, Nightmare Over Ragged Hollow, which is currently being kickstarted. The Kickstarter runs until August 2nd. So you can still jump in there. There's still time left. But it looks fantastic. It's beautiful. I'm so excited to be part of a project that has such great art. Please buy it for the art, if not for my words.
Those of you who have seen previous Merry Mushmen stuff like Nock or A Folklore Bestiary, which you all have, right? You've all bought
Naturally.
It.
Naturally. Of course.
I'm just saying. Looking at the preview PDF, it's up to the standard of what we've come to expect from Eric and Olivier and their team.
Yeah. The illustrations by Leon are fantastic.
Yeah. Just gorgeous, and very in keeping with that kind of like low level starting adventurer folk fantasy.
Yeah, it feels very much more fairy tale, folktale styling.
That cover looks like this is the adventure adaptation of a kid's fantasy cartoon from the 80s. That
it does. I was just going to say from the 80s.
Yeah,
it's ticking on all those nostalgia buttons for me.
Absolutely. All right. Fantastic. Well, look, thank you so much for having come on the show. Before we go, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit more about where they can find you and your work online?
Oh, gosh, sure. So my official publishing name is Joseph R. Lewis, and you can find all of my stuff at josephrlewis.com. All of my adventure stuff is under the title Dungeon Age, and you can find all of that on dungeonage.com. Those are the two best places to find and connect to me, because I don't know what other platforms are going to exist in the days and months ahead. So
I think we're all being forced to consider that problem at the moment.
That is why I have my own website. I encourage everyone to have their own websites, josephrlewis.com.
All right, Joe, thank you so much once again for being on the show. Everyone else, that's Nightmare Over Ragged Hollow, currently on Kickstarter from the Merry Mushmen. We'll put a link down in the description. Next week, we're back to our journey through the Arabian Nights inspired fantasy of Al-Qadim, so I hope that you will join me then, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram @MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.